Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Andrew Farah. Andrew is the CEO of Density, the leading space analytics platform for measuring and improving workspaces. On the podcast, we dive into methods to effectively measure office usage accurately without compromising privacy, why butts in seats is an outdated metric, and how to build smarter offices that adapt in real time. Andrew's uniquely vast data-driven insights on the return-to-office struggle is well worth a listen for any office occupier or commercial real estate investor.
Andrew, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I know we've wanted to have this conversation for a while. I think it's a very interesting subject. But before we dive into offices, can you tell me a little bit about what got you started in the world of offices and productivity and kind of how people use space?
Yeah, sure. We essentially built radar sensors that count people inside buildings. And we started because we wanted to know how busy our favorite coffee shop was. And it was really annoying that we, you know, could know the weather in Spain in real time, but we couldn't know if there was a line at Cafe Cubal down the street. And so we kind of looked for some technology that could do this. And we found hundreds of products that purported to count people in buildings, but just did a really terrible job of it. Mostly around just like latency and accuracy and like, they were invasive and all this stuff. So we were like, well, it can't be that hard to build. Turns out it's extremely hard to build. And for the last 11 years, I have been working with a really extraordinary team to design and build radar sensors that anonymously count people in buildings. And that's what led me to real estate and workplace and a whole bunch of other really interesting industries. That's what Density is, and that's what Density does.
So I know we've had conversations on this podcast with so many brokers and investors and developers about measuring office use. And I'm curious, how do you go about measuring office use while also allowing for privacy? Because that's one of the biggest issues that we hear about is people are like, oh, we'll just put cameras in there. It's like nobody wants a camera on them 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. So how do you go about that process?
Well, in our case, we designed a product that's anonymous at source. So that this radar sensor behind me is it can't tell that I'm Andrew, even if it wanted to. That's not the same with most camera-based vendors, where even if they anonymize the image, there's like a bunch of providers that do like, they call them optical sensors, which is really it's just a camera. It's like, it's just, it's marketing for a camera. And what it's doing is they get deployed above a person's desk and then they take photographs of whether or not you're at your desk. And then they process those images locally on device or on a gateway. And then they publish, count data. And cameras are very good at counting people. But if you want to go, if you want to take the high road and you don't want to be invasive and you also don't want to be a legal team's like worst nightmare, you will build technology that sort of preserves privacy at source, which means like it literally can't do it if it wanted to. And I think that the value of that is that when we hit NetSec or network security, or we hit InfoSec, information security, we breeze through. Because people aren't concerned about what the device is collecting. When an optical sensor, or you know, AKA camera, hits InfoSec, they have to do a lot of work to justify how they are preserving privacy. And I'll just give you like two very practical examples. One of the folks that's in the industry, they deployed it above a bunch of desks, and someone noticed. One of the employees noticed, and they filed a lawsuit. The company actually has the right to observe you with a camera, but there's a difference between having a reasonable expectation to privacy and having a security camera. Like, a security camera is there to keep you secure. A camera that's just there to, like, observe if you're at your desk or, like, what you're typing into. Like, those are, like, the types of things that you just don't want to do. So, anyway, that's, like, maybe the very long answer to your question. And then the second story I would mention is that, you know, a legal team's responsibility is to limit the liability of an organization. One of the biggest liabilities in any organization is their supply chain. And so if you can compromise a third-party vendor, we work with some of the largest companies in the world. These are some of the most secure offices in the world. If you can compromise the optical sensor vendor, you can do keystroke logging. You can measure what people are typing into their keyboard. You can see what IP is on their desk. And if I'm China, the thing that I want to go talk to the folks that I want to compromise are the sensor vendors, because, like, forget trying to get into, like, you know, these large corporates. I can just get in through a back door.
Yeah, that's very true. And I'll say this, as a JD who took privacy law and took a number of tort law classes that relate to this, I can only imagine all the legal potential issues that could come with cameras. In terms of that, one of the things that I was curious and that come along with cameras and sensors is, like, looking at kind of understanding how people use the space, because the biggest thing and biggest conversation I have with not only occupiers, but other brokers and other investors is kind of understanding how people are actually using workspace. And what we see overwhelmingly is you have your data, and then you have what people tell you they're doing in their workspace, and there's usually a vast chasm between them. I'm curious kind of how that perceived reality and more of that data-driven reality coming from a very accurate system like yours, you see playing out.
Sure. So, you know, like, when you talk to someone, you're like, hey, how often do you go to the gym? And they're like, you know, three times a week. Like, the reality is, like, if you had a log of how many times I went to the gym, it probably wouldn't be three times a week. And it's not because humans are actively lying. It's because humans are pretty bad at record keeping. And so, if you say, like, hey, you know, are there available meeting rooms? They'll be like, there's never available meeting rooms. I can never find an available meeting room, you know? Or are you able to find a desk when you need it? And they'll be like, no, it's, like, always swamped. But then when you look at the data, and we have a lot of it, when you look at the data, I think the number that was probably most staggering was that something like 38%, nearly 40% of all desks were untouched for, like, 90 days. Post RTO, post return to office. And I went and interviewed, I was, like, on site for this particular customer, and I talked to dozens of employees, and they were all walking around looking for a desk. And you know what had happened? The teams that had come back had claimed territory for their teams. And they're not trying to do it in, like, a nefarious way. They just were like, no, this is for, like, the ad group, or that's for the engineering group, or that's for, sorry, but, like, no, this area is for. And so people were sitting there wandering around looking for space to do work. And then they're furious about return to office, because they're like, you asked me to come back and then you don't allocate space to us. And then I'm sitting here wandering around, wasting time both at my commute and also in my, like, I'm just looking for space. And it turns out at no point during the entirety of return to office for that particular company did they ever fully run out of meeting rooms. There was always a meeting room available. There was always a desk available. And the problem was twofold. One was a visibility problem. You need to give the data back to people that are coming into the office. Like, show them which rooms are available. Show them which desks are available. You know, or at least show them which neighborhoods might have desks. That's one. Don't just observe them, like, give them useful data, let them self-police. And on the other end, like, don't book rooms that you don't use. So like 27%, I'm thinking of another group in New York, of all of their meetings were ghost meetings. That means that people booked the room, but they never showed up. And so like, it's just crazy that we're willing to lock up nearly 30% of our entire portfolio of one of the most valuable assets, which is like where people come to gather and collaborate, just simply because of the seniority of who booked and reserved the room ahead of time. And so again, there is plenty of space. There just is. And if you give visibility to where, it becomes sort of a self-policing system. And it's also like apolitical. It just is, right? It doesn't have an agenda. It's like, here's where there's free space. Here's where there isn't free space. And then everyone can make better decisions instead of these like political debates about, I need this and it's not there. Or, no, my team must have all this dedicated space, even though they're not using it. So.
And do you think that's the big difference between, I know a lot of individuals who have implemented key card monitoring and key card data access, but that really only shows you that somebody entered and it doesn't even show you if somebody exited in many cases. Yeah. I'm curious, do you think that's the biggest gap that you see kind of between like using sensors on one hand and using just like key card data?
Well, there's a couple problems with key card data. The first is that you don't badge into a floor usually. You also definitely don't badge into a room usually. Yeah. And you certainly don't badge into a desk or a phone booth. And so it's really just a question of like is visitation to a building what you're trying to answer? If you've got 2,000 employees that work in a building and you're figuring out that like, you know, 1,800 of them swiped their badge, you know, or tapped their badge, I can guarantee you that a portion of those are a buddy carrying the other person's badge and like coffee badging them in. And the reason I can guarantee that is because we have literally witnessed it. Like it is literally just a thing. So that's one. But even if you have like perfect attendance, like people are just showing up every, you know, and they're like, there is no sort of like surreptitious badging in, which by the way is like, we should treat adults like adults. So I just want to say, like, you shouldn't deploy sensing in order to police behavior. You should deploy sensing to like make use of the building and make it better for the people it was intended for. Like we forget sometimes that buildings are built for humans. Like we didn't build these buildings to sit there like monoliths. We built these buildings for like humans to use and interact with and do work, you know? And like, we're not doing that's not happening. We just have like ghost towns. And if you've ever been to, I promise I'll get back to the badging, but if you've ever been to like an empty movie theater or like where there's one other person and they like sort of like, they like are perfectly equidistant from each other and the walls. Like that's what happens in like a ghost town office is like you don't sit next to each other, and so like you either need to constrain the space or you need to up the occupancy, like up the number of people that show up. So anyway, that's like one of the primary problems with badging is that you tend to only badge into the building. You don't badge into the individual space. So you have zero visibility into what's actually getting used, where you're actually running out, where you're not. And then the other problem is that most people don't badge out. Yeah. So some buildings have that, but you're not getting occupancy data. You're getting visitation. And so a visitation is a 5-minute visit. There's no difference to the 5-hour visit. Unless you have obviously like the badge out on the other side. And then there's all the PII stuff that then I forgot. There's like a third category, which is like, then all of a sudden you have to like take personally identifiable information and like trust that it will be anonymized and not used punitively to make decisions about real estate. And I just think like, there's just a better way. And it's like inexpensive. It doesn't cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to put in some like badge reader. You could just like quickly understand what's getting used and what isn't.
So I wanted to talk about return to office along with this as well, because it kind of ropes in and comes into the whole badge swipe world. And I know there's so many individuals that we've worked with that are occupiers that have had all these problems with return to office, be it, you know, ghost swipes with individuals that are tag teaming their return or individuals that are just stopping by in the process in their sweats, swiping in and leaving. We've seen this over and over again with a number of occupiers that have had return to office struggles. And I'm curious, what have you seen in terms of effective return to office policy? Because you've really done this on a broad swath of industries. And I think you would have unique insight listeners, many of which are both occupiers, large occupiers, or investors that are kind of understanding how they could maybe help and return to this process.
Sure.
Or in their portfolio.
So I have a number of thoughts, but I think the thing that people underestimate is that the amount of trust that you can build in person is like 2, 3, or 4 times more than the amount of trust that you can build distributed. It's not that you can't get to 100% of like the gas tank of trust distributed, right? You could just spend more time together distributed. It's that the gas tank size is like 2 or 3 times larger when you're in person. And I think it has a lot to do with like nonverbal communication. I think it has a lot to do with you not being super limited by the calendar invite. Like if you imagine like your digital interactions are highly structured. It's like you have your 25-minute discussion and then you have 5 minutes transition to your next 25-minute avatar discussion. You know, you're an avatar the entire time. You know, it's easy to go off video and go off mute and or on mute and sort of like do other things. Like it remote creates the conditions for an absence of connection or a reduction in connection. So that's premise number one. And perhaps number two, because in-person does the opposite. So buildings and return to office, in my opinion, should not be about making sure people are doing work. It should be about building high trust teams. If you mandate in-person return, you are choosing to value investing in and trying to build a high trust team. And a high trust team is upstream of conflict resolution. And high trust teams resolve conflict better, more productively, right? They make it about the work, not about the individuals. Conflict resolution is the only way to build great products. And so trust is upstream of building great products, which is upstream of building a great business. And so I think what the trap that people get into is describing return to office as like water cooler moments or like culture and collaboration and we do our best work when really it's actually like pretty simple. It's like you are going to trust each other more if you are interacting in person more often. That's it. That's one. The next thing is that I think that leaders are pretty chicken shit about talking about why they're doing this policy. What I think the best leaders in the industry are saying is they'll mention something about trust, and then they will likely say, look, for 80% of the policies we create, the company's incentives and the company's interests are going to align with the employee's interests. But for 20% of them, they're going to deviate, where our policy is actually only in the best interest of the company and not in the best interest of the individual. And in those moments, we just want to be really clear, and RTO is one of them. We are always going to choose the company. That's our job. Like we are managers of the company. Our job is to choose the company 100% of the time. But we also want to be honest with you that like that 20%, like it exists, you know, and it sucks that it's in conflict with what it means to have flexibility in your schedule and time, and particularly childcare. I think companies like they talk about this, but the biggest reason, I am convinced, the biggest reason why hybrid is valued is childcare.
Yeah. I can say from somebody who's done a tremendous amount of economic development work in our community, both in the broader Chicagoland area as well as on the county level, that is 100%. When you're looking at surveys, all the data we've seen, the number one driver is childcare by far. And I think overwhelmingly, occupiers underestimate the amount that their employees that are, you know, married or not married, even individuals with children that are either having to pay in time or pay in money, childcare costs, and how it was substantially reduced due to the flexibility they got from remote work. And yeah, I could not agree with you more. Just had to intervene because
no, yeah, totally.
See it over and over and over in the data. And if companies are looking to solve remote work, the biggest solution is childcare.
Yeah. And I think like this is why like folks migrate to be closer to family. You know, it's like this very practical thing, which is childcare, both the cost and the time. I think someone's going to figure this out, and I'm not sure who or when or how. And I know that some folks have figured this out, but there's some brilliant business model, which is like we have underutilized office buildings. Of the 9 floors that we have, let's keep 8 and let's turn the other 2 into a daycare. For our employees, and like it will just be a perk, and I guarantee you return to office, like attendance will skyrocket. And the thing is that's crazy about this is that we get so wrapped up in talking about things like inclusion and diversity, and I realize like the pendulum has swung massively over the last few years around this topic, but like this cascades, like not having good policies, not having clear policies, and then not having support for things like childcare cascades into the number of women that can even make that happen. And that's a generalization. There's plenty of stay-at-home dads. But my point is that there are practical solutions to this, and there are parts that an organization and a company can play a role in, but they've got to be willing to say the words out loud. And then the last thing that is like really important is that they have to be willing to let people walk. Like attrition is the most corrosive, fear-based, like fear is the mind killer, like Dune, like we are so scared of like having clear, strict, not even strict, clear policies and boundaries around what it means to do a return to office out of fear of losing top talent. And the reality is that like if you ask someone, do you want more or less freedom? They will always say more freedom. There's a right answer to that question. If you say, do you want more or fewer flex days, flexible days or, choose your own adventure days, there's a right answer to that question. It's yes. But that doesn't mean that what's in the best interest of the individual is serving the company or serving the team or serving the mission of and purpose of the organization. And so it's not that you can't have exceptions to like the guidelines, but I think that what can be very helpful is like, look, here are our boundaries. So in our case, we are mandated 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Wednesday, choose your own adventure, work from wherever, also a no meeting day. Now that doesn't always get followed, but that's the goal is like focus and a break midweek. And then on the other days, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, you are expected in office by 10 a.m. at the latest, and you may not leave until 3. And the reason for that is that we want to acknowledge that commute sucks on either side. So we'd like to reduce some of the pain there so you don't have to show up like at 9 or show up at 8:30 or whatever during rush hour. And the second thing is be an adult in between that time. Like I don't care if you need to go home and take care of your kids. I don't care if you need to go to the dentist or pack for a vacation or like just be an adult, like within those constraints, be an adult. But like, we're going to give you constraints so that when you schedule a meeting at 2:00, you're not wondering whether or not someone leaves early at 2, right? You have this shared understanding of like the rule set we're all playing, the game that we are all playing together. And like, I think companies, if they did something like that, they might see results that are unexpected. And in our case, the average, like something like 44% of everyone in our office stays until like 5:30 or 6 every day, even though they're like, we're kicking them out at 3. And so like, I think I've said a lot, but like humans in a place creates gravity, like it creates a critical mass. But if you don't have enough people in the space, you have the movie theater problem. And when you have the movie theater problem, someone might as well just be going and like watching Netflix at home. When you have like the Minecraft problem, I don't know if you saw those like TikTok videos of like the Minecraft movie where people are going nuts in the, like it's like a whole experience in a theater, even though you're not supposed to talk. So, yeah.
Beyond the Minecraft problem, which I have Gen Z family, including a younger brother. And that's a whole different world that I get into. But one of the biggest things where you're talking about gravity, and I think this is very underutilized, is that there's so many people that need training that are younger in the process, be them interns or be them younger associates at groups or younger staff. And what we saw from our occupiers was not having them there. It's okay for the older folks. And by older folks, I mean anybody who's been there for, you know, a couple years, it doesn't really matter. Like my wife, she works for a big law firm. And the younger associates, it didn't matter. Or the younger associates who are, you know, in the business 4 or 5 years at a firm, it didn't matter that they weren't there. But the associates that were in their first or second year during COVID, they didn't know how to make phone calls. They hadn't sat in on negotiations. And then when it came time for them to move up the chain to be a senior associate, they didn't have the skills that were necessary. And that just comes from, you know, teams that have that cultural capital that's been developed and something that's really, I think, underutilized. And so,
yeah.
I'm curious, when we're talking about underutilized things and cultural capital, one of the most toxic environments in terms of a discussion about it is kind of the federal office space use. And I know that you've done federal offices as part of your monitoring. So I'm curious if we could talk a little bit about that, kind of how you've seen that process play out. And we don't have to get political. We're not a political podcast, but how federal offices are used plays out on a economic issue for not just people who are looking at return to office, but also we have folks that invest in federal office REITs, and they want to know, you know, how bad it could be for their portfolio.
Sure. To your previous point about kind of mentorship. Mentorship is like a phenomenal, and even like being an apprentice to a thing or to someone is very hard to do distributed. I think we talk about return to office as though like everyone previously was in an office, but there's an entire group of people who are coming to the office for the first time. They don't know what it means to like work in person with colleagues. They know what it's like to like log into a screen because they were in college before they had their first job during COVID. So, as to the federal real estate thing, you know, there's some pretty brass tacks. Like there's 300 million square feet of space. It's approximately 300 million square feet of space. Their goal is to reduce by more than half. They're probably going to settle around 200 million. So if you're like trying to figure out, this isn't financial advice, just to be clear, but like if you're trying to figure out like, and who knows with, you know, the sort of the winds of the administration and what they actually can accomplish and so forth. Like there's just like a lot of things that are outside of anyone's control. However, I know and have spent some time with the people that are behind, the very thoughtful people that are behind the federal real estate the services group. So the General Services Administration. And I'm not talking about like DOGE is like an, you know, it's formerly the United States Digital Service. DOGE is not a new department. It's an old department that was created by the Obama administration. It's just being purposed. And actually some of its mandate is the same, but it's being repurposed for sort of like the stated goals. The General Services Administration is a very specific group who has been trying to consolidate unused federal space for 20 years. Like this group is like, they were lowest on the totem pole in terms of political influence. And now they're number one, number two. And it's because there's such colossal waste. The US federal government has, I believe, a 1.1 billion square foot overall portfolio. The portion that's within the control of the General Services Administration is about 300 million square feet. They have 4,000 leases expiring in the next 3 years. We have an enormous amount of deferred maintenance. The GSA's budget to invest in literally decrepit buildings just to make sure that they're not going to hurt somebody has been raided over and over and over again. They don't have any money to do it because Congress keeps taking it away. So the reality is that it is long overdue for a major consolidation. And I think what you can expect to, one thing that people don't realize about the federal government, I certainly didn't until we started, you know, interacting with some of them. And just to be clear, our deployments were pre-COVID, during COVID. It sort of like fizzled out when everybody went home. And so today it's like a very different conversation. But I would say back then we sort of had some preliminary data, but it got very weird with COVID. What I didn't realize is that the federal government, when you own a building, you have to get congressionally approved dollars in a budget. When you lease a building, GSA has full control to negotiate. Yeah. So you can sign and get rid of leases as the General Services Administration at your whim. You can negotiate prices. You can decide to. But when you get appropriated dollars, you have to use those dollars. And if you want to like make any changes to a building that you bought, you have to get congressional approval to do so. So to give you a practical example of this, literally 5 years ago, the General Services Administration, on recommendation of the PBRB, which is the Public Buildings Reform Board, made a recommendation of 12 buildings that were federally owned that could be sold. I believe none of them. I believe what happened was they finally got it approved. OMB rejected it until the Trump administration sort of V1 came in. They approved it. OMB approved it. And they only just in the last, I want to say 6 months, got rid of their like 10th or 11th building. And we're talking 12 buildings. They identified an additional 40 during the Biden administration. Zero got approved by the OMB. So the reality is that the incentives are to do nothing. The incentives are to buy buildings and do nothing. And the actual reality is that if you were to you know, leased buildings pay taxes. Owned buildings are tax exempt. Federal government owns a building. Like, there's no taxes flowing from that space out to the local community. Federal government leases a building. There are actual taxes. Like, you can have the owner paying property taxes. So there's like all these benefits to having leased property that I think we've really under invested in.
Yeah. We lease to the federal government in a couple different ways. And I'll say this. We found generally our federal negotiations to be reasonable in terms of the leasing process. Now, we're not leasing to large agencies, typically, at least on a large scale, but generally reasonable. But what we've seen is in terms of government properties that have been government-owned properties, they have been at the very least, not efficiently run. I think that from our perspective, that's definitely something we've seen as well. I'm curious, when we talk about though effective strategies, I'd like to talk kind of about what you see in terms of defining where, when, and how work happens, because that's, I think, one of the places you have the most insight on in terms of efficiency and designing effective workspaces, particularly in the whole idea of workspaces being productive and designing for efficiency, not just efficiency of experience, but efficiency of actual work product. What do you think is like the biggest myth ultimately and kind of like how we work and versus how we think we work and how we're effectively using space?
I think that people think that meetings equal work. And I think a lot of remote folks would agree with this, that like, that meetings do not equal work. like, I think they'll say like being in person and doing a meeting is like not work. That's like preparation for work or planning for work or whatever. But what I think is the other side of that coin, like heads down focus time is like when real work happens. And meetings are like mechanisms to like create context, shared context. And so like, if you have good shared context, then the team's going to row in the same direction. The problem is that we think that meetings mean work. And so a lot of people like do work all week by just like being in meetings, you know? And I think that there are some functions where that like totally is reasonable, but I think there are a lot of functions that are just like play acting at doing work because they're just in meetings all the time. So anyway, that is tends to be the strongest argument against return to office. It's like, I'm just going to come back to be in meetings all day. And I would just say like, the reality is that how and what work means is a function of your culture, not a function of where you are. So NVIDIA famously, and is like a terrible example because they're such an outlier. NVIDIA doesn't have any in-person policy, but that's because they are literally the baseline of an entire industry and they're the only ones. Like AMD is like barely there. I think that if you look at the most aggressive startups right now, they're all in person. They just are, and like they're unwilling to compromise on this. And I also think like sometimes it's just simpler of a problem than people make it out to be. They think it's about space design, and it can be. They think it's about like, is it a flywheel setup or is it a dog bone setup? Is it a 6-person meeting rooms? Is it 25 phone booths? Is it dual booths? Like we sort of have like over intellectualized the problem. The problem is we have too much space or we don't have enough people. And like, that's kind of it. Like if you can play with either of those, you either decrease the amount of space that you have, shut off floors, and it will naturally increase with the existing population, the critical mass that you have on those floors. Or you keep the total square footage and you increase the assigned headcount. Just to be clear, the number of people assigned to the building should always be more than its capacity. Always. Even if you don't have desk sharing. Because people are traveling or they're out sick or they're, you know, doing meetings elsewhere or whatever else, like you're never at 100% capacity. And so people are like, oh, our vacancy rates are, you know, 3%, 4% because they've assigned everyone a desk. But the reality is like their actual vacancy should be determined by use, like utilization. Your vacancy rate is actually 41%. It's 38%. It's these colossal wastes of space. And so all you have to do is shrink the amount of space or increase the assigned headcount. And you will end up, humans literally just like naturally become communities. They like create norms and they create culture and they do all the things that you need from a productive team to build a great business. And I think a recent example that I heard about is actually, what's the name? You know, MyChart? Yeah. MyChart is like essentially a monopoly. It was designed by she was an engineer before like there were like software engineers and they're like in the middle of the country and
Epic, right?
Epic Systems. Yeah. That's right. Epic Systems, like probably the most successful privately owned company in the world. And they built their own campus and like, they've got crazy like Wonderland structures and, you know, Alice in Wonderland stuff. And like, you are required to be there. It is wild. But like, that is a culture. That's like a culture happening to itself and like reinforcing itself. And I think we just like, we deluded ourselves into thinking that distributed work is the equivalent. And it's just, it's not zero, but it's not the same. It's different. And we should like accept it for its strengths and not assume that it's the same.
It's hard for me to argue against that as somebody who's seen over and over with some of the occupiers we work with. I think that your point about the size of spaces being probably the most important is something I've seen play out. We found what was interesting is there's one occupier we worked with, and I won't name the name because it doesn't sound good, but particularly for the occupier, but they had an executive that was a local executive. And we advised them because we're honest with people. We're not just trying to get a commission. That we said, you know, we really think that your space, you probably need only about 65% of the space you currently need. And, you know, maybe you can make it 70%, but, you know, we think you should scale back at least 2/3. And he responded to us and he said, you know, I really don't want to decrease space because my office might get a little smaller. And I love my corner office being big, and I love the space and the freedom. And I don't really want to downsize. And we're like, yeah, it'd probably be good. It'd save you guys money and save your time. And he's like, no, we're going to go to corporate and say we need to save you space. And what we found is when we looked out into their space, it was exactly what you saw, where you was individuals kind of all separate apart. And it wasn't a space where, you know, you had teams operating. What you had is you had a couple individuals, maybe a friend here or two, but it wasn't a full utilized space. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So when we're looking for trying to find truth on this podcast, one of the things that we love to do is we love to get into our final four. And that's always a fun conversation to kind of learn a little bit more about you, learn a little bit more about where you see the world going, and also get a couple recommendations. So the first question we always ask is, where do you see workspace going 10 years out?
I think that a lot of, I think that we're going to see a lot of people benefiting from self-driving. And I think that offices or private offices or spaces to do work will show up in like weirdly configured self-driving machines, you know, where you're like facing each other instead of like facing the road, and you're like doing work while you're traveling to New Hampshire from California, but you'll like have been in a space that's like, you know, feels like a remote work. So I think that like, obviously that's like a check in, like the remote work box. I think that there's going to be I think that we have assumed that the digitization of tools means that the conclusion is going to be different in how humans work together. And I just don't buy it. And not out of bias. Like, we have a bias towards measuring humans in space. But I would say just in general, I think that the tools and technologies that we can use today, like this, for instance, allow us to do quite a bit more with folks that are like not immediately proximate. But I don't think that that changes the fundamental value of being in the same place with another human. And a good example of this is actually like looking at cities. So when we sort of invented the car, there were many car companies, by the way. In like Ford's time, there were you throw a rock and you'd hit a car company. Everybody and their mother had a car company. But when the car revolution sort of happened, we started building roads. And when we started building roads, that created secondary and tertiary cities. And there's a great essay about this. It talks about like how the car created the suburbs. But what people sort of fail to I think maybe like really wrestle with is that the cities, they thought cities were going to suffer, but they didn't. Like cities are not like, they didn't just like empty out, right? Manhattan is not empty. San Francisco is not empty. There are times where it like sort of rubber bands into these different directions where it's like quiet, but price and demand for being in a city has always been a, you know, prices will fluctuate, but demand always remains regardless of the suburbs. I think the same thing has happened with, you can think of like being in an office with other people as a city, and technology change and improvement in Zoom and all these other things as the invention of the car and roads. And it allows us to do some other things, secondary and tertiary things, like extend the network of people that you might interact with. But it's not a replacement for what it means to be in the same room yelling over a whiteboard. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think technology is in many ways a good band-aid for some of the gaps that we get in community and interpersonal interaction. But I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, there are members of our team where we'll be fighting over price on a song for, and to have that conversation over Zoom or over some sort of a video messaging platform, it wouldn't do it justice. And I feel like we wouldn't be able to have some of the tough conversations that we have, particularly just daily interactions where we run into that. I would struggle to agree more. In terms of something though that we always like to go forward, and then we also like to go back. And so one of the questions that I always love to ask is, if you could have given yourself a little bit of advice when you were starting off in your career, what would it be?
I mean, there's so many things that I would tell myself if I were younger. you know, actually, one thing I wanted to mention on the previous question that I think is maybe...
That's totally fine, yeah.
I just to call out, like, I think in 10 years, the size of companies relative to their revenue is going to be like dramatically different. And we're already starting to see this, like 20 person teams generating $100 million in revenue in their first year of in their first like 2 years of operation, like Cursor and some of these others. The revenue ramp and the revenue per employee, I think, is going to go like way up. And so that will reduce the demand and need for space, because you can build big businesses without needing a lot of people. However, I think we're just going to see way more businesses get built. And so I don't think it changes maybe the overall thrust. And then the other thing is, I think people are going to be talking to their computers all the time. I think you'll have really high quality, large language models sitting on your laptop, being able to interact with you with or without the internet. And you will have dozens and dozens and dozens of them doing various tasks that normally you would require a human for. And so all of these things sort of like terminate at smaller teams or bigger teams doing 10, 100x more work than they can today. So I think that's probably the biggest impact. The buildings will sort of be I think, have some type of an impact, but work is going to change fundamentally. Well, there are some people that believe that work won't exist 10 years out. I'm not of them, but I would say, it's a wonderful and weird and fascinating time, and it's only ever going to happen once. This is never going to happen again when we start to like interact with an intelligence that is not us, like this. And so I just, you know, someone once told me, too young, to explore the earth. Too old to explore the earth, too young to venture amongst the stars. But we get AI. We get to experience AI.
So in terms of that, I think it's always funny that you see like Mark Andreessen and Bill Gates talking about, you know, well, there'll still be, you know, venture capital or whatever. Everyone always seems to think that they won't be replaced by AI, but everyone else will. When we see that, I think it's going to absolutely transform the way we work. It already does for us. I know for a lot of our processes on the early end of the spectrum, we're already using AI agents to magnify the amount of value we can provide. And in terms of providing that value, we're seeing it, you know, teams are shrinking. Like, you used to have to be a really competent brokerage, a vast team of agents. Now it's, you really need like five really good agents, and you could do any deal, any business. So quality is vastly more important. And then, as you mentioned, you see the team size shrink. And I think now, there used to be in like the 1980s and 90s, economists would always look at businesses in terms of how they were valued, and they'd look at headcount. And I think that's totally going to change, just as you mentioned. It's going to be, instead of headcount, people are just going to look at, you know, total value per...
Yeah, profits per head. That's right. Yeah.
And yep. That's something that we're already starting to see, particularly in some of the businesses, and we have a number of these coming on, data center companies, where you have, you know, four employees running a multi-billion-dollar data center, it's not the way that people would have perceived some sort of large facility back in, you know, the 1980s or 90s. So. Sure. In terms of that, I will go back to it and do a follow up on that last question I asked you, though, which we all
are hopeful.
Yeah. Which is, any individuals that are listening to this podcast are young. What kind of advice could you give somebody starting off in their career?
I would encourage, I would encourage you to read what you love until you love to read. I think the number of humans in the, like the percentage of humans in this world who actually read regularly, not just for entertainment, but like just generally, they're just kind of like omnivorous readers, is pretty small. And when you look at the, I think there's like another side to that, which is like you only get, if you read so much and that's all you ever are, is like just encountering new ideas, right? Like that's also like a downside. But like, I think if you're trying to figure out how to like meaningfully change the difference between you and say the next competing person, I would say like, don't try to compete, just go read, go like explore your own curiosities and explore the curiosities of other people. Books are one of the very few things that you can literally put yourself in the mindset of the author at the time that they were having these ideas. And it's like a cheat code on stuff. And so that's like a really practical one. It's also easy for me to say that, like, people will not take this advice, but like, I strongly recommend that.
I'm an avid reader. I'm not always, admittedly, physically reading, which I do. But
yeah, sure.
A lot of it is books and tape as well. If you could give one recommendation for a book that someone could pick up, what would it be?
Well, our conference rooms are named after books. So I'll tell you the names of the conference rooms. The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli is phenomenal. He's a physicist. He writes like a poet though. And he talks about like literally time and how time like doesn't exist. It's like a really wild book and it's really small. Recommend reading it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. One is called Endurance. It's about Ernest Shackleton. And especially his navigator. Endurance is like it's like a real story. It's insane. Yeah. Read that book. It reads like an adventure novel and it's totally all just real. Also Shackleton is not as cool as Woolsey, who's his navigator. Like he gets all the credit, Shackleton, but Woolsey, I think his name is Woolsey, is the reason they all like, it's the reason they're like alive. Like it's like an amazing story.
So as a sailor, who took celestial nav, the ability for him to actually hit the island where they were targeting at the end, I mean, we're talking slight percentages that he would have gotten it right.
Same.
In like high seas, he's able to get accurate readings. I mean,
insane.
Who took celestial nav? I'm like,
insane.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
So, and in terms of all the navigation,
insane. Yeah, just awesome. So that's a great one. Contact by Carl Sagan. It's a fiction book. There's a film about it with Jodie Foster. Just like the book is awesome. Read the book. Unreasonable Hospitality is about 11 Madison Park. As one of our conference rooms, it's about essentially like what it was like to make that restaurant work. And there's some incredible lessons in it. And then I'm sitting in the Lessons from History by Will Durant and Ariel Durant. And that one is like super narrow, but it's probably one of the best written books I've ever come across. So I just read as much as you can from as many people as possible. It doesn't have to be educational. Just like read stuff that you love and then eventually just like love reading.
So that's totally an acceptable answer, but there's one that we won't let you get out of except for giving us at least one name. And that's final four. We always say the men and women who are in the arena know the other men and women who are in the arena that we should be talking to next about their topic of expertise. And I'm curious, who should we talk to next?
That's a good question. I think that the world of real estate is going through like quite a bit of change. And there's some people that are some very good thinkers that I would encourage you to talk to. One of them is a guy named Phil Kirshner. Do you know who he is?
I've heard the name, but I don't know Phil.
He is a former McKinsey, former WeWork, does a lot of stuff on his own. And he's like the right mix of like provocative and like clear. Yeah. And I think there are a lot, so I would encourage you to talk to Phil. Phil's awesome. I also think like there are a lot of people who have not been given agency, but like in real estate's the second most expensive thing next to payroll. And yet we don't give them the same control and agency over what to do and decide in buildings. as we do HR and finance when it comes to like people or recruiting, right? Like enormous amounts of capital and agency going into those like types of functions. And as a result, real estate becomes a service function for the business. The business decides the building needs, not the building professionals. And I think, I don't know that it'll flip, but I think for the companies that really know what they're doing, it'll flip and they'll actually just give agency to the real estate heads. And Phil Kirshner is, I think, a really good avatar for some of that. He's been that, he's supported that, he's excellent.
Well, we're going to definitely reach out to Phil. But before we go, if somebody wants to reach out to you or Density,
sure.
What's the best way to get in contact?
Just andrew@density.io. You can just send me an email. You can also find me on Twitter, just Andrew or X, Andrew Farah, or on LinkedIn. And then just density.io is a good place to go. This is our self-installable radar sensor. So you can buy it and deploy it in about 5 minutes. We care a lot about this problem of like humans in buildings. People are extraordinarily weird. They do a lot of strange stuff in physical buildings. And preserving privacy feels like something that the future needs, as opposed to, something that we have to like unwind some surveillance. And so technology ought to respect that.
Well, we respect having you on the podcast and we respect your time. And we're so grateful that you came on today. And thank you so much for hopping on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, Gordon. Anytime.
Thanks again to Andrew. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star review, any sort of interaction, be it comments and subscriptions. Truly matter, and it helps us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.